All the interviews we've replayed this week have come from 1987, the year Fresh Air started on NPR as a national daily broadcast. But before that, Fresh Air was a local show in Philadelphia with a weekly edition produced for NPR. This next interview with Richard Price is from that series. It was in 1985, before Price had written the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, and Mad Dog and Glory, and long before he wrote the novel Clockers and worked on HBO's The Wire. His novel The Wanderers had been published, though, and so had The Breaks, a novel written the year before Price spoke with Terry Gross.
The character in The Breaks is the first character, main character, in any of your novels to have actually finished college. Most of your novels are about characters who come out of working class, lower middle class neighborhoods in the Bronx. Were there a lot of writers writing about those kinds of neighborhoods when your first novel was published?
Well, if there were, the novel might never have gotten published. This is something that I usually say about that the whole situation of me trying to be a writer in that kind of environment. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the poverty or something. It was basically, you know, working class neighborhood. What happens, though, in a working class neighborhood is that the parents are children of people that try to scratch livings out of the Depression. So my parents were kids during the Depression, haunted by economic survival. And if it was in the 60s, and you were the first kid in that family to go to college, and you wanted to do something in which there was no blue chip guarantee of a professional job at the end of the education, they thought you were nuts. So the brightest minds of my housing project and millions of housing projects like that across America, I would guess, would go to engineering school or medical school because there was a job. If you were going to Cornell like I did, and your father's putting the money together for you to go, and you want to be something like a poet or a painter or a dancer, they would look at you like you were mentally defective and you were wasting their money. So it was very hard for a kid to get the validation to do something creative. Myself, I was so psyched out by that thinking that even though I wanted to be a writer, I got a degree in labor relations.
Just so you could
just because I didn't feel
right
like
thing.
Well, I thought, well, gee, maybe writing could be a hobby, you know, and then it sort of took over. When I was in college.
It seems important for all of your characters to get out of the neighborhood and to break away from the family, but it's really difficult for most of them to achieve that. Mm-hmm. Were you in that kind of situation? Was it hard for you to get out? Was college your ticket out?
I used to think it was just a matter of like getting away from the family or some doctrinaire attitude about, you know, the politics of, you know, families smothering children or economic survival. I think it's more like this general feeling I had all my life, which I think a lot of people have, which is, where is it? You know, it's like you're looking for it and you're trying to escape something because what you're doing now, there's an old Lord Buckley routine where there's a conquistador. Lord Buckley was a jazz comic in the early 50s, and he had a routine about Cabeza de Vaca, where a conquistador was looking for India, wound up in St. Petersburg, Florida. And what he said to his troops is, we didn't know where we was, but we knew where we was wasn't it. And I think what I've been writing about is that feeling of like escape. It's not the family, it's not the economics, it's something intangible. And I used to think it was something tangible, like economics or family, but it's that feeling of like, I still feel it, no matter what you have, you're over here, but it's over there. And the minute you're over there, it's over here. You know, and it's that zip-zip roadrunner game that you play with something that you can't get a hold of that I think I've been writing about all along.
But it's interesting, once you got out of the Bronx and you actually started writing, what you were writing about was the thing that you left, which was the Bronx and family.
Well, that's the only way. I mean, what else can you write about? I used to teach writing, and I don't think you can write about anything if you're surrounded by it, because you can't see the forest for the trees, to use a cliche. When I went away to college, my life changed so radically. And I knew I was never going to go back. And it was something in my life finally that had the end attached to it, which a lot of young writers don't have because there's not that much that has finished in their life. And I had gone, after Cornell, I had gone to Stanford, which I'd never been out of New York State in my life. And I knew whether I liked the Bronx or didn't like the Bronx, it was over. It was a part of my life that was over. And it would only exist as long as I could remember it. And it had nothing to do whether it was good or bad. It was just a part of my life that was finished. And out of that panic of losing a part of my life, I forced it to crystallize, you know, to write it down just before it escaped, you know, and I got senile or something.
Once you left the Bronx and you were with other people who weren't from the Bronx, did you start making that, did you start mythologizing that into something maybe larger than it was or different from what it was?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was sort of mythologized at more than me self-promoting the fact that I was Bruce Springsteen or Lou Reed or something like that. I mean, I think what happened is that basically I was a Jewish working class kid, and I wrote about Italian kids because I had felt sort of psyched out because I felt, what could I say after Philip Roth or after Michael Gold or somebody like that? So I thought, and I knew, you know, I grew up in a housing project which was pretty eclectic, and it's collection of people. It was truly integrated. So I, you know, I was rubbing elbows with everybody, so it was just as easy for me to write about Italians. But what happened is when the book came out, I became the first person since James Farrell wrote Studs Lonergan or Hubert Selby wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn to get down into grits and the depth and everything. So everybody assumed that I graduated from Odyssey House as opposed to college, or, you know, I write with a switchblade. You know, people were, like, scared of me, and it got to the point where they were kind of disappointed that I wasn't even Catholic, you know. I mean, people sort of wanted me to be this guy who wrote with his femur, you know, dipped in his victim's blood or something. You know, and I got kind of caught up in that, you know, because it's like I was 24 at the time, and, you know, you don't know whether to go to the bathroom or wind your watch half the time when you're 24 and you're getting all this stuff thrown at you, and you're getting, you know, you have a hard time knowing who you are, let alone getting this romanticized media thing thrown at you about yourself, and you start buying your own copy after a while. So then I started lying. I told people I was formerly Catholic, or, you know, or I went to a different high school than I really did, you know. I went to DeWitt Clinton instead of Bronx High School of Science or something. But
did you develop a thicker accent?
Well, that happened not from writing The Wanderers. That happened because when I went away to Cornell up in Ithaca, New York, I felt so threatened by all these people who had real, like, Midwestern accents. If they came from Peru or Indiana, it was equally exotic to me because I had never met anybody outside. I thought the whole world was Italians, blacks, Jews, and Catholics. I never met a white Protestant person in my life before. And I felt very threatened by everybody else's sort of exoticism. So I think as a matter of survival, I sort of intensified my own exoticism, and I developed a worse Bronx accent in Ithaca, New York than I ever had in the Bronx because I never needed it before.
The first novel, The Wanderers, was about street gangs in the Bronx, teenage gangs. Were you ever in a gang? Did you have friends in gangs?
There's a comedian that I forgot the guy's name. I think it was, well, I don't know what his name is, but he had this thing that he was in the Goldberg gang. And I said it was no real big deal. We'd walk down the street and somebody would say, "Hey, here comes the Goldberg gang." And somebody else would say, "Big deal, what are they going to do, algebra?" You know, that was kind of, you know. I mean, like I said, you know, I rubbed elbows with, like, tougher kids, you know, and nobody ever wants to be who they are. Everybody's, you know, kids want to be, like, athletes or, you know, like a Jewish kid wants to be James Brown. It's like, tell me I'm not who I am. Tell me there's something else out there.
What I figure you probably were, though, was the comedian and the writer.
I was, like, class clown, you know, and yeah, I was, you know, well, what happens is, like, when you're 13 years old and it's like, you know, you can't tolerate just being like everybody else, so you got to find some ace in the hole that you have that would sort of elevate you above everybody else. And everybody tries to pick a specialty, whether it's being a math genius or, like, you have a nice voice or you're, like, a beautiful girl. Or, you know, for me, it was being the poet because, and you know, it just took my run-of-the-mill adolescent mopiness and instead of being mopey, I was being, like, melancholic, sensitive, you know. I wasn't lonely. I was the lone wolf, you know, because us poets, you know, we have to suffer. And, you know, it just elevated the pedestrianness of my adolescence in my own mind. So I was more interested in the rapping than the gift. Yeah, I didn't know if I had any talent or not. I just liked the idea of being a poet. That's what I grabbed onto.
What about being funny? Was that important too?
Yeah, sure. It was just a survival. It's just, you know, you want to stand out. You want to be different. Anybody who's a writer or a painter or anything in the arts, is no portrait of mental health. I mean, I think what one of the things above and beyond the desire to make art is this feeling of that it is intolerable to not stand out, to not be noticed, you know, and you're going to, when you're a kid, you're usually like really weird and on the edge of things and you're a lemon. And then if you become a successful artist in some way, you've learned how to make lemonade out of the lemon that you were, you know. But what the underbelly of it is I have to be an artist. I have to take this loneliness and this perimeterhood and make it work, you know, because there's no way on earth that I could be like undistinguished. You know, it's not a happy or a proud choice. It's a desperate choice.
Well, I hope you don't mind my mentioning this, but your right arm is I don't know exactly what the problem is, but you don't have, I think,
well, I have cerebral palsy, and it's like a mild thing. It's like some people notice it, some people don't. But for me, since we're doing Dr. Freud, I think for me, what it was is that when I was a little kid, everybody treated me like different and special. It's like, what's wrong with your hand? What's wrong with your arm like that? And on one hand, it's kind of depressing, pardon the pun, it's kind of depressing, you know, to be noticed for that stuff. But on the other hand, you get hooked on everybody, you know, thinking of you as a little different, even though it's sort of a weird thing to be, you know. I just, for everybody, I think there's something. Look, if I had sort of like a perfect Nazi android body, I think it would be something else. You know, just for me, it was just the hand. If it wasn't for the hand, it would be something else.
Your first two novels were about Italian families. The second two novels starred Jewish main characters. Why did you make the switch?
Well, I got tired of passing. you know, it's like imitation of life. I just realized, well, what happened is I realized that the people that I had to write about were not the Portnoys and were not, you know, Saul Bellow characters or basically working class people. I wasn't writing about the Jewish culture or the Italian culture. I was writing about working class culture. And the fact is that I did know working class Jews better than I did knew working class Italians. And as I got older, I became into myself a little bit more and I felt less of a need. I was getting farther and farther away from that wanting to be James Brown or wanting to be not me. You know, I felt, you feel a little bit better about yourself. And I realized I had all this untapped territory. I wasn't writing about, you know, the oi 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 Jews, and I wasn't writing about the Jewish intellectuals living on West End Avenue. So I was neither Cynthia Ozick or Philip Roth or Bruce J. Friedman. I had a housing project, people that could either be Jewish or Italian. The Judaism was not that important to them. You know, if you look at the last two books, I mean, nobody goes to synagogue or nobody talks about the Holocaust or something. It's like they're New Yorkers, really.
Did you listen to a lot of Lenny Bruce?
Well, Lenny Bruce is my hero in terms of, I think my two heroes in terms of writing were Lenny Bruce, in a funny way, and Hubert Selby, because Hubert Selby was the first time I ever read anything that was of my time that was in print. And so therefore I found my own experience as valid grounds for literature. Even though I might have been crazy about Oliver Twist, Oliver Twist didn't play in Epoxide Projects. And Lenny Bruce, the way he spoke and his pacing or his humor. And first, my first exposure to Lenny Bruce is they had a book called The Essential Lenny Bruce, which is a paperback, which are just basically transcripts of his club acts. And I saw that on paper, and it was like 3D, the words. It was my introduction to like perfect, ear-perfect dialogue because it was tape transcripts. And I never saw language. I never saw a page alive like that. So Hubert Selby told me it was okay to write about where I came from, and Lenny Bruce told me sort of how to talk about it.
There's a lot of rock and roll in your novels. Characters are always putting on records that are really important to them. What did rock and roll mean for you when you were growing up?
The same thing, pretty much what I said, which is escape. It's like, I'm not me, I'm Dion. I'm not me, I'm James Brown. I'm up there and I'm wearing these gold lamé tight pants with a satin cummerbund and flamenco heel shoes, and I've got 9 pounds of pomade in my hair, and I'm flipping a mic out 90 miles an hour every way to compass, and nobody has ever seen anything like this, and I'm covered with sweat, and I got a voice that could shatter glass in another zip code, man. It, you know, and what it all boils down to is I'm not me. Thank God. Here we go. it's, you know, it's, you know, I had my ticket. I had my airplane ticket every time I put a record on.
Richard Price, speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. We've been celebrating the 20th anniversary of Fresh Air this week by listening back to some of our favorite interviews from our earliest days on NPR. It was 20 years ago today that we started the daily national edition of Fresh Air on NPR. I was part of that show, reviewing the finale of Hill Street Blues. How time crawls. That day also was Irving Berlin's 99th birthday. And on that inaugural National Daily Fresh Air show, we invited singer Peggy King to perform an all-Irving Berlin concert, accompanied by pianist Michael Nbehe. Here she is in the Fresh Air studios, singing Always.